And also to study isolated objects like individual galaxies, here a galactic disk, and galaxy collisions. And recently it has become possible also to study things like the cosmic magnetic field in the intergalactic medium. So instead of giving you a review about all of these possibilities, I just took the freedom and selected three subjects of my own work, largely. And I want to briefly go through them. First one is the growth of supermassive black holes and how you can incorporate something like this in cosmological SPH simulations in a semi-phenomenological fashion. And I'll show you some results of that work that I recently carried out and started with Tiziano Di Matteo and Lars Hernquist. Then I'll discuss a bit the Lyman alpha forest and metal enrichment from cosmological simulation of galaxy formation that drive galactic winds, metal-enriched winds, into the low-density gas. And I'll show you just some key properties of that. And I think Joop will talk a lot more about the physics of this in detail and show where these models presently fail. And then finally, very briefly, I want to go into some recent work I've done with Klaus Stolak and Dario Grasso and Igor Chakev on cosmic magnetic fields in these SPH simulations. So the goal of cosmological SPH simulations, broadly speaking, is to study formation of galaxies. And this here, for example, is a typical simulation at redshift zero, where you see the gas distribution in large scales, typical filamentary network, of course. And then embedded in it are the halos and clusters and galaxies of various sizes, with stars actually, in this case, embedded in them. So the goal is really, in this case, to start from cosmological initial conditions at the time of recombination, say, and follow then the fluctuations to the present day and form all the luminous galaxies in the universe. So that's obviously all the full program then of galaxy formation, and it is extremely complicated. One of the complications is the dynamic range, of course, and the other, which for example brings me to this Zeno's paradox that I really like. If you want to form the galaxies in such a simulation, obviously we can't stop the calculation once we form the first star and once we collapse down to the first star. So part of this game will always be to incorporate prescriptions for the unknown physics on very small scales and somehow do that in a fashion that still reliably models the effect of these unresolved physics onto the larger scales. So I want to explain these points a bit more. So if you really go forward and try to follow the gas down to redshift zero, then obviously you encounter galaxy formation, star formation process on the way. And if you have to simulate this process, you immediately get a lot of trouble that you have to deal with. For example, there's this well-known cooling catastrophe. This is just meaning that radiative cooling is so efficient that just a large amount of the cosmic gas will condense out and collapse to very high overdensity and presumably go to star formation. And if you would just convert all of these barons to stars, you would get way too many of them. That's a well-known problem, and it has always been assumed that some of the complicated physical processes in the interstellar medium will prevent this gas from going to stars. Instead, the star formation in the ISM should be regulated somehow by thermal processes, energy input, for example, by supernova feedback, maybe by magnetic fields or cosmic ray pressure, etc., etc. All of this physics is unfortunately relatively poorly understood at this point. It is understood at some level, but not at the level that we can simulate that from first principles at this point. So our approach to that complication is that we essentially make a very simple sub-resolution model that is motivated by basic physics and with the hope that it's sufficient to, at least on average, describe accurately what's going on these small unresolved scales, for example, in terms of star formation, and while still being able to capture then the effects of that physics onto resolved larger scales. The other problem is the huge dynamic range that you encounter. It is simply impossible to simulate on the scales that SIME kind of asked for, several hundred megaparsec, all of the galaxy mass spectrum down to even the smallest four of galaxies. For that, we require particle numbers comparable to the Millennium simulation, but also in the gas, and that's just computational too expensive. We also want to do this in the gas. Our strategy to circumvent that problem has typically been to run simulations on various box sizes and combine them to obtain then a composite answer to various questions that you might ask. Here's an example of a simulation program that we have run to study primarily cosmic star formation rate history and the properties of galaxies on various scales. You see here that each of these colored series here is a simulation series. It was run in different box sizes. So this blue series here, for example, used 100 megaparsec boxes. Then we had 33 megaparsec, 10 megaparsec, and so on. And then for each of these box sizes, we have aggressively studied resolution effects by changing the particle number systematically, using the same large-scale phases in initial conditions so that you can study convergence also for individual galaxies. And I'll show you some examples later on of that approach. These simulations basically these sort of bread and butter of cosmological SPH simulations have reached these days substantial sizes. So 2 times 324 cubed particles is about 110 million or so. The largest computations where I've been involved were about twice as big, 2 times 480 cubed. But that's still about 100 times smaller than the simulation that Simon just discussed. Even so, it's probably the largest SPH calculation in this area carried out so far. Now, let me go now into the first topic that I announced in the beginning, how we treat the growth of supermassive black holes in galaxies in these simulations. So this is a model that we recently developed, and the motivation is pretty obvious to you, of course, that first of all, there is strong observational evidence that suggests a link between black hole growth and galaxy formation. And Simon mentioned some of these things already. There's the M-sigma relationship, similarity between the cosmic star formation history and quasar evolution, and a few other maybe more indirect hints. And simultaneously, there are theoretical models that assume that this black hole growth may be self-regulated by strong feedback processes. For example, already Silk and Rees many years ago proposed that the growth of the black holes might stop once the black hole has reached a size that allows it to drive out the rest of the gas in the halo so that the accretion on it will necessarily stop. If this is really true, such a model, then it's obvious that there must be an interplay between black hole physics and the formation of the galaxy, because after all, if you drive out all of the gas from the halo, then star formation has to stop. Then also feedback will possibly play an important role in solving a lot of nagging problems that we have otherwise in simulations. For example, the cooling flow riddle in clusters of galaxies. How do we understand that the gas doesn't cool out, even if it gives off all this X-ray radiation? And maybe AGN heating is one of the solutions. Also, the fact that the ellipticals are so red and gas poor, some of the massive ones, may be related to this AGN feedback. So to summarize all of this, I think it's obvious that galaxy formation models need to include the growth and feedback of black holes self-consistently. And I think Simon's talk already showed this very nicely, that you have to do this in order to explain even basic things like the luminosity function of galaxies. And if this is true in semi-analytic models and in these analytic theories, then this certainly also applies to simulations. And that was the starting point of this work that I'm now going to discuss. So how do we do this? Now, in simulations, we make a very simple model. First of all, we have black hole particles. These are just collisionless sink particles that are able to accrete gas from their surroundings. We compute or estimate in a relatively crude way an accretion rate onto these black holes using a Bondi-Hoy-Littleton parameterization. So this is this formula. And we limit this to the Eddington rate of the black hole. Then we assume that standard radiative efficiency of the hole, and that some of this bolometric luminosity couples thermally to the surrounding gas. So there's a free coefficient here, which we typically, in our typical set of simulations, actually in all of them, we set to 5%. Then we explore the properties of this model first in isolated galaxies. There it's easiest to understand what's going on. So we construct this also with a new method, motivated basically with a structure motivated by cosmological simulations. They have a dark matter halo, this galaxy, a stellar gases disk, a bulge, and a central supermassive black hole. And then you can set them up so that they're pretty stable. And I just want to show you how one of these looks like. Okay, now you can see it. So this is a three-dimensional disk galaxy model. As you see here, this is the gases disk, and it's happily rotating and forming stars. And at the center of it, you'll see a funny feature, which we'll come to in a minute. That's the accreting black hole. And actually, if you look at the galaxy from the side, you see a little bit of red stuff here. But this is hot gas now. Actually, a small outflow, which I'll show you later, blown out from this quiescently accreting black hole here in the center. Right?
Is that a live dark halo?
Pardon me?
Is that a live dark halo?
This is a live dark matter halo, yes. This hot spot here is basically the accretion region now of this black hole accreting particle where it's heating the local gas. Is this, and this model is isotropically. Now, in these galaxy models, I haven't really explained this in detail, what we do to model a star formation. This is a sub-resolution model for the multiphase structure of the ISM, which is rather simple, but it can be boiled down basically to a modified effective equation of state for the highly overdense star-forming gas. And this turns out to be very important to explain or to understand the stability of these galaxies, of course, especially if they're very gas-rich. Now, here you see a systematic parameter study where we varied the gas fraction in these disks. Each column here is a different gas fraction in this disk, so we start here from 10%, pretty low value. The rest, the other 90%, would be stellar disk. You go basically up to 100%. And then each row is a different equation of state. In the bottom row, you see an isothermal gas, 10 to the 4K, that has been traditionally used quite often in these simulations for isolated galaxies. There you see basically that you can't have a strongly self-gravitating cold gases disk. It will break up into lumps. So it's basically impossible, such a model, to actually have a gas-dominated disk for a long time. It will always go unstable. While for such a sub-resolution model with an effective pressurization now from supernova feedback, we can stabilize the disk quite nicely. So that is one of the reasons why we can now run disk galaxies with a large gas fraction. Now let me discuss a little bit how this black hole mass growth proceeds in this simple model. If you just put in a seed mass hole with mass M0, then initially, if the mass is small, we will just do Bondi growth, basically, with the given density and sound speed of this gas. That will go on for a while, for basically the Bondi time or so, until this denominator here gets close to zero. And then we'll have an explosive growth that very quickly will then join on, which will be moderated then by the Eddington limit that we impose. So then we basically slow down to just exponential growth at this point on the Salpeter time for a few times 10 to the 7 years. And here is a growth rate now of such a hole as a function of time. In blue, you see what happens if you just put in this black hole like that into the gas without any feedback processes. And then first, we have this relatively slow Bondi growth that accelerates. Eventually, we got to exponential Eddington growth, which goes on until basically gas is all gone if there's no feedback process simultaneously followed. Now, the feedback has here the effect, as you see here, that it will slow down the growth because it's heating up the local gas, and that, of course, enters the Bondi rate, which reacts sensitively to an increase of the sound speed. And so you can slow down the growth. Eventually, it tapers off to some more or less fixed mass, and that you can work out is related in this model to basically a balance of the local heating rate and the local cooling rate. And turns out that for a typical halo, there's already built into this relationship between the black hole mass and the very velocity of the halo. And then if we study how the black holes grow in halos of different circle velocities, so different sizes, we see that in larger halos, the black holes reach much larger terminal masses. And I come back to this. So this is for isolated galaxies, how this relates then to mergers of spiral galaxies. A typical time sequence of such a merger is shown here, right? So we collide to these galaxies. This is a very common picture in these simulations. They collide, pass each other for first time, and the gravitational field distorts the galaxies. You form tidal arms, and you usually drive in gas to the nuclei of these two galaxies and fuel their starburst. And if there's a black hole, then it will also fuel an accretion event. And that I want to show you next in a collision here. So we have two spiral galaxies approaching each other. This is, again, the gaseous disks. They have now the first encounter. Here there are some shocks in this overlapping region. And the gravitational fields, the tidal forces distort now these galaxies into a pair of bisymmetric spirals. And we form a strong bar here. Along this bar, we have a strong gas inflow into the center, driving a nuclear burst of in star formation, but also strong accretion strong accretion onto the black holes. Now, they grow rapidly now on adding, with the adding rate, eventually reach a size where they start to drive a powerful quasar outflow, which you see here in action. So the gas gets essentially blown out. Now, galaxies come together for a second time. A lot of the gas is already gone. Black holes merge, and they feed again on the gas, as you see here, and blow out more or less the rest. Now, we're left here with an elliptical remnant. You see only the gas that's left, so this is why you see almost nothing. The stars are, of course, still here and form elliptical remnant, which is now pretty gas poor. So let's look at the accretion rate a little bit more. Here is a bulgeless disk merger. So the accretion and star formation, our starburst pattern, depend a bit on the structural properties of the galaxies. If you collide disk galaxies without a bulge, then it's very easy to destroy the disks and form strong nuclear inflows already in the first encounter. That's, you see here, you have strong growth already in the first encounter. Accretion rate reaches the adding rate for a time of roughly 2 Salpeter times or so. So you have basic strong quasar activity 2 times with corresponding star bursts of star formation. If you take bulges into these models, you kind of stabilize the disk and you moderate the first starburst quite substantially so that all the action happens in the second collision. But the upshot of this is that these details don't really matter that much. If you now collide or galaxies of different sizes and look at the final black hole masses and how they correlate with the velocity dispersion of the bulges that are formed, then you obtain this diagram. The black hole mass versus the bulge velocity dispersion here measured like the observers do in the center of these remnants. And the colored dots here are our simulation results. And the empty symbols are for other models with different gas fractions initially. And this is here compared to basically the data from Tremain and others on the M-sigma relationship. And you see that the agreement is actually remarkably good. We're exploring this yet. That was at redshift 0, whether this involves with redshift. I don't want to make a statement on this yet. I think maybe. But this is the wind. And this whole thing doesn't depend strongly on the orbital geometry that we've tested also. And the other thing that we can look at, here's, for example, a comparison now of such a starburst in emergence simulation with black holes and without. The black holes have the ability now to terminate the star formation rate after the galaxies have coalesced. And that obviously imprints as a remarked difference in the color evolution here of the remnants. This is the U minus R color versus time in these two simulations with black holes and without black holes. And you see that after this extreme bluing event here corresponding to the starburst itself, the remnant redden in both cases relatively quickly because of the drop of the star formation rate, but much more quickly so in the simulations with black holes. Actually, it's almost consistent with no star at all after time 2 giga years in this case. That would be the black line, while the simulation without black hole shows residual star formation. So we have here a method to really make this galaxy, this remnant, pretty dead, so it doesn't really do any star formation yet and will redden quickly. And you can study this as a function of galaxy size. Here are now tracks in the color magnitude plane of various merger remnants. The symbols here are spaced half a giga year apart. And you see that this little excursion here is basically the burst that then the remnant very rapidly moves into the red regime. And we argued in this paper that this would be a method maybe to explain or to help shaping the bimodal color distribution of galaxies, because you very quickly move those guys with the black hole feedback to the very red regime. And you approximate, reproduce the mean trends observed to that. So this is here the merging. I don't want to go into this. What also helps is actually the stellar surface brightness profiles. This is an old problem that these starbursting simulations always left behind a new luminous spike in the center. That is a problem that has been more or less solved. I'm going to skip the rest of this and come a little bit to Lyman alpha forest simulations. So here we have a cosmological simulation with a Lyman break galaxy, a resolution study. The red star color here are the stars that formed, and the blue is the gas in the background. You see that as we move to higher resolution, we resolve more galaxies, smaller ones, but the bigger galaxies, they even visually you can make out that they are reproduced, and also the amount of stars forming in them is reproduced. So we have very good convergence with these sub-resolution models. At the same time, you see that the structure in the gas is resolved finer. And actually, this is a slide that Simon already showed. If we look at these Xerophon galaxies up close, we see that around them, there are funny features in the gas, like here, these shells and these holes. And these features are actually coming from gas that has been driven out of these galaxies. But you see this here very clearly, that these holes are filled with hot gas. And also metal-enriched gas. So here's a method now to bring out metals into the IGM. And what I'm going to show in a few slides is what these winds do now to the properties of the IGM. Here's a phase-based diagram of the gas volume averaged. You see the normal equation of state of the IGM. So most of the volume sits at this power law relationship. And if we have winds, we get an additional plume of volume now here, which is heated way above the average temperatures that are normally in this regime. So, and the question, first of all, is how much of the volume is this? And the answer in these calculations, it's not very much. It's about 80% or so, this differential volume distribution that is now heated substantially. And then the question is this enough to leave or to produce traces in the Lyman alpha forest, which might maybe spoil the agreement that we otherwise have with the properties in these simulations. Normally, here's a typical spectrum without winds. That's one with winds. And certainly, visually, without statistical analysis, you wouldn't be able to tell that there's a substantial problem now in the simulation with the winds. Even though these are the same lines of sight, there are substantial transmissions imprinted now due to the winds, but they are not sufficient to destroy the statistical properties, as I'll show you in a minute. Also, wherever there is a difference in transmission, there's also then a difference in velocity, difference in temperature, and difference in metallicity. Actually, here I cheated that I selected the 8 lines of sight in this previous diagram, which showed the largest differences. Random lines of sight typically show much fewer of these enriched regions due to the winds. And you can already see that in simulations without such winds, there would be basically no metallicity in a significant volume left. What we can simulate quite well these days is sort of the regular properties of the forest. For example, if you decompose that in Voigt profiles, is a B parameter distribution that converges extremely nicely, nicer than in previous work, I would say. Also, the column density distribution works out quite well. And even for the very, very high column density systems, 10 to the 16 or so, which was usually a problem, there are some small effects on the flux power spectrum due to the winds, but this is on the 10 or 20% level. Now, why are the effects so small? It's largely because the enriched regions and the affected regions are so small, and if they're and most of them are actually not absorbing any Lyman alpha because they're of too hot and of too low density. Now, here is the metal enrichment pattern now resulting from such SPH simulations. Here again, the Lyman break galaxy, the biggest one in this box, and a few other galaxies around it. This is now the projected metal distribution, again, for different resolution. So visually, you see that it reasonably converges from these winds. The first question you might then ask is, okay, where are the metals in which, if you make an inventory, at which gas densities do the metals reside? First of all, the green result here is for calculation without any winds, you see that basically all of the metals, so the area under this curve would be all of the metals, all of them are confined to highly overdense gas. So in our calculations, the metal stay in the interstellar media if we don't have galactic winds. There is no enrichment process due to mergers alone and to stripping off metals by dynamical processes. If we have strong winds, then we develop here bimodal distribution. So there is now metals piling up in low density gas. And this is exactly the stuff that's driven out. Again, the convergence, which I don't want to discuss, is reasonable, even so not perfect. Here, the polluted volume fraction. The polluted volume fraction is the volume above a certain metallicity. As I already said, there's a green line here, which basically coincides with the axis on this linear plot. Right? If we don't have any winds, there is the volume fraction is essentially zero, right? It's below 1% or so. Only if we have this wind model, we come up to at 10⁻³ or so, we have 50% of the volume is enriched to 10⁻³ or larger. But the point is that this is still substantially smaller than the filling factors that are inferred for the observed data here from Jobs. Paper at -3, it would be already way above 20%. This is not that different from this result, but the key thing is that it extends nicely to still lower metallicities, and so that. I didn't know that. Sure, but still, I mean, you know that there are issues with the metal distribution. It's certainly too inhomogeneous. I think that's one of the bottom lines you can draw from it. And there's too much volume, probably not enriched, even though the mean metallicity, if you just average over all the volume, you're roughly in the region that you desire. So let me spend the last two or three minutes, if you allow. On some very recent work, I just want to mention here, it's possible to include a treatment of magnetohydrodynamics, ideal MHD in SPH, even though this treatment is only reliable in a regime where the magnetic force are subdominant, so it's not really applicable to the really interesting regime of MHD. But there are interesting applications, particularly for cosmological magnetic fields, which are generally pretty weak and usually dynamically unimportant. So we can study that here. So the evidence for magnetic fields in the universe, in diffuse gas, comes primarily from clusters, for example, from synchrotron emission in radio halos and from relativistic electrons. And that, of course, is direct evidence that they're then magnetic fields. And they are inferred to be at the level of fractions of a microgauss. Faraday rotation measures also give you magnetic fields of roughly the same strength. While outside of clusters, we don't really know much about extragalactic magnetic fields. They are basically upper limits in the order of nanogauss. So with coherence lengths of 50 to a megaparsec or so when they extend to cosmological distances. Now, there are different scenarios for how magnetic fields arise here. One of them is a pollution scenario at low redshift, that they're just driven away with winds, locked into the gas from galaxies or AGN, or that they are generated at much higher redshift, either due to from a cosmological origin or generated by the same mechanism, more or less, in dwarf galaxies. And that scenario is the one we explored in our simulation. So we started from a seed field at high redshift that we then amplified in the structure formation process to produce the galaxy, the magnetic fields in structures such as galaxy clusters. The Biermann battery process in merger shocks is also a possibility. The problem here is that it produces only very meek magnetic fields, so you will need to have a second stage amplification process, which has to be very efficient. Could be a turbulent dynamo, but nobody can really simulate this yet, so we haven't even tried. So we rather focused on this amplification process. So here's a result from a little cut through the density field from a constrained realization of the local universe. And here I show the magnetic field now from the Centaurus cluster through a group of other few clusters. Here's the density field through the stretch. The gray regions are the viral radii of the various clusters. And here we look at the magnetic field. And you see that in the big void here, the magnetic field is pretty low. It also doesn't change orientation that much, while it does that quite frequently than in the viralized structures. then we can compare the rotation measurements, for example, in the profile in the clusters. That's reproducing measurements pretty nicely. Also, the correlations between here, for example, radio power and temperature of the clusters are pretty well reproduced. So this is all kind of suggesting that the magnetic field structure is pretty plausible in these models. And in this case, really, clusters stick out here as big mountains in the magnetic field, while the typical field strength in lower density region stays much lower. The primary application we have done so far on this is to study whether these magnetic fields now in the local universe would lead to sizable deflections of ultra-high energy cosmic rays, so relativistic protons traveling to us from large distances. This is a very important question because eventually you want to pinpoint the sources of these protons. And if they are, of course, deflected all over the place by intergalactic magnetic fields, you couldn't do that. So here's the all-sky map now of these deflections, and you see that there are the real structures in the local universe reproduced in the simulation. There's no ambiguity in your observer position. You have the Perseus cluster, Virgo, Coma, Hydra, Centaurus, and so on, all at the right place, all of the right mass. You see that for the most largest part of the sky, deflections are actually well below a degree. So that is kind of suggesting that you, this is for a small a region that's closer to us. Of course, it depends how far you want to go out. Here you see a cumulative plot of the fraction of the sky above a certain deflection angle. And this is also then reproduced with a simple scaling model that we use to extrapolate this to still higher, larger distances. So the net bottom line of this part of the analysis is that basic cosmic ray or astronomy with ultra-high energy cosmic ray particles would, in principle, seem possible based on this model for the magnetic field in the local universe. So let me conclude then. We have formulated a new numerical method which allows us to carry out high-resolution cosmological simulations that track the growth of galactic supermassive black holes, and currently we are actively exploring that in cosmological simulations, not only in individual galaxy collisions. In this model, the growth of black holes is self-regulated, and we can show that merger remnants reproduce the Magorian relationship very nicely. That's one highlight of that analysis so far. We have a complex interplay between starburst and nuclear age and activity, and I think that's really corroborating the point that these effects need to be treated consistently and at the same time for realistic models of galaxy formation. So I step over these two points and just make some conclusions here as well. In the line of force, I think we have, this is a highlight, of course, of the CDM theory, and the effect of winds in the form we implemented them so far doesn't destroy that success. We have, however, some problems left and a lot of work to do to still really understand the metal enrichment properties. We see some metal enrichment due to these bubbles, but it might not fit in detail the properties that are observed. And that's something that for the future, I think, will opens up new possibilities if one gets MHD implementation also to work in a strong field regime. And what we can do so far is to study the weak fields in clusters of galaxies and in the sheets and filaments in the low-density universe quite reliably. And from that, I think we find that the prospects for also astronomy for ultra-high energy cosmic rays seem to be promising still. Thanks.
Oh, sorry. So, Volker, in the simulation that you showed, it looked like the ratio of star formation to black hole accretion was about 1,000, which would be consistent, I guess, with the Magorian relation. So, for that ratio, for your assumed efficiency of production of kinetic energy by the AGN, roughly the amount of kinetic energy from AGN and supernovae are comparable. But it looked like the AGN wind had a much more dramatic effect on the ISM than feedback from supernovae. And I'm just wondering why that is, or you would comment on that?
Yeah, I agree with your first comment that roughly this the mass accretion rates, is the ratio is about 1,000 or so. So that should be consistent with what's generally observed. I think my my main explanation for why this wind is so more powerful from the IGN in this particular model is that all this energy is dumped in one particular spot, while in the disk it's spread out everywhere, and so there's plenty of opportunity to radiate away this gas. It's just a, I think it's primarily the spreading out of the energy in the supernova. Yes, correct. Yeah, that's the other. Of course, yeah, the accretion concentrates it also within, you know, one Sylpeter time or so. That's another important point. Yeah.
You had a question about the metal enrichment. So, in the real intergalactic medium, whenever you see a metal line, you always see a neutral hydrogen line associated with it. So you were commenting you have about the right volumes enriched with metals, but I suspect in your simulation the metals are in regions which are too hot to have any Lyman alpha, so it's not clear you would actually reproduce the observation.
Yeah, I tend to agree with this. That's actually what we find. Yes. Yeah.
A follow-on question. Your slides went by very fast on the forest, but they were tantalizing nonetheless. In the H1 line statistics alone, or any other metric you like, could you see any difference between the enriched simulation and the simulation without feedback?
Yeah, it's very subtle. It's very subtle. In the line statistic, you mean in the Voigt profile?
Anything.
Statistic?
I mean, this confirms my suspicion that it's going to be a subtle effect if you just confine yourself to the H1 absorption.
Yeah, it is a subtle effect. So what there are a few effects, though. We see actually that the lines are on average slightly hotter, right? They're slightly broader, but it's hard, you know, you need good statistics in the simulation. You actually have to look hard to convince yourself that there is an effect. Then the flux power spectrum has these 10-20% differences, 5-10% differences in all other quantities, the 1 point statistics of flux distribution and so on. So it's at the percent level you vary the mean transmission and so on. So it's very subtle. I always suspect maybe if one tries harder to actually look at the line shapes themselves, that one could see some more more subtle effects, right? If one can show deviations, say, from Voigt profiles that might be present more in the simulations with the winds, that just the features that they're imprinted there could be slightly different from normal Voigt profiles.
I have two related questions. What's the time interval between the bar-driven starburst and the final merge of two black holes? And what's the ratio created during the first phase versus after the binary merge?
I didn't get the second part, sorry.
What's the time interval between the bar instability-driven starburst and the merge of the black holes in equal mass galaxy model?
Yeah, it's... Let me go back. Show you a plot for that. It's too slow. It's about, you know, it's half a giga year or so. It depends, I mean, from the first collision to the here. That's the point. So here you see the basic galaxy cores. This is the separation of the two black holes. This is the first encounter. Galaxies separate again. There's the second encounter. Roughly here is the big burst, the big accretion. And, you know, then kind of separate again, and there would be a ringing. And sometime here, you would now form a black hole binary, which would have to harden. That's not resolved in the simulation at all. So the stellar dynamic process that would harden the binary and so on was the gas dynamical processes. So we actually, where this diamond is, we merge the two black holes. Once their relative separation is within their density smoothing lengths that they use to determine the local gas density, and once the relative velocity is below the sound speed of the gas, at that point we just merge those two guys. I mean, it's not clear whether you can just, you know, from, you see that these intervals after minimum of the separations become, you know, very, very short and shorter, And, you know, a naive extrapolation would tell you that they merge really, you know, before 1.7 gigahertz have elapsed. But of course, you don't really know what the binary does here. So we just merge in at that point.
And the first phase dominates the accretion?
The first here? No, that depends on the structural properties of these galaxies. If this galaxy is a stable galaxy with a strong bulge or so, and it depends on the orbit as well, how much accretion you have, how much you trigger here as opposed to the final coalescence.
Okay.
We have both cases. We have simulations, but this is more important than this. But I think for the more generic galaxies kind of which have a bulge, this will be typically not as important as this. That's my feeling.
When we compare the Mike Norman simulations of the IGM to the high-resolution data, we also get an excellent fit to B-value distribution at redshift 2, zero feedback, right? Mm-hmm. And it fits well within the,
yes,
the errors in the data. But we found it was sensitive to obvious things that are mentioned in the literature, such as the sigma 8 you choose, or the amount of heating through the high-energy photons, helium-2 reionization, etc.
Yes.
And if we didn't pay attention to those parameters, we would not get an excellent fit to the B-value,
yes,
distribution.
Yes.
So what did you have to do to get your fit, if it's not the feedback?
It's not the feedback, first of all. It's just, I agree that there are dependencies on the cosmological parameters, how hot the IGM is, maybe how much variance you have, etc. I mean, this was a standard concordance LCD model, and for that it just works out. So we haven't really run other sigma 8s or whatever. So I think that's basically the fact that we roughly matched it at that time is probably expected because we have the right cosmological parameters. It's just another consistency. I'm not sure. The question would be, do you get for these parameters something else that doesn't
Which spectrum did you use, for instance?
Ionizing
spectrum?
That's a Hardin-Nadal background flux. Just.
You're optically thin?
Everything optically thin, yeah.
There are basically two modes of accretion onto the black hole. One has to do with a quiescent galaxy that is not merging with any other galaxy, in which bars drive gas towards the center. The second mode has to do with mergers. And it was not clear to me in your simulations whether the black hole grows significantly in mass in the quiescent phase or not. Because in the real universe, we see a correlation between the properties of black holes and the bulges.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in order, you know, so if you have just a spiral galaxy with no bulge, you don't see a massive black hole in it, even if the galaxy is quite massive.
Yes.
And so it seems like mergers are really necessary to drive a lot of gas in order to make. But the other issue is that when we look at galaxies even though there are gas reservoirs that could feed the black hole, for example, in the galactic center, we don't see much accretion onto the black hole. I mean, the galactic center is an excellent example of that. So it's not at all clear that the Bondi rate gives you a good approximation. In the galactic center, it's off by many orders of magnitude. And so my question is, in your simulations, when you assume the Bondi rate, do you grow a lot the black hole mass just in quiescent galaxies or not?
We basically, you know, we do grow it in quiescent galaxies to a certain point because the black hole has basically accessed, in this case, in the quiescent case, the result of this residual growth that we get is also somewhat resolution dependent, basically, because then the black hole can feed on the gas that's basically in the very center of the galaxy, okay? And that gas is heated basically by the feedback, and once a balance is established between the heating from the black hole and the cooling rate, so basically once this gas can cool off, all the energy radiated off, the other way around. Once this gas can't cool off the feedback energy from the black hole anymore, then this residual growth stops, okay? So it might be an inconsistency. We do have black holes, you know, after all, we need to start from something, right? And a spiral galaxy without any nuclear component is anywhere relatively rare in the galaxy. And I'm not convinced whether it's really clear that there's absolutely no black hole lurking there, or, you know, whether it's just a very small hole. We do get a very small hole with this model, right? But I would argue, you're right, the M-sigma relationship is between bulges, and that's why to form a bulge in the standard model, you usually form one, of course, in a merger. And so if there's a bulge already in a galaxy, then the black hole mass should basically probes the bulge during its formation, right, and gets then there, at that point, the right mass. But, you know, still, we have just started with that model. There's still a lot to be learned. And the problem is a bit with the pre-constructed compound galaxies, you have a lot of freedom, right? So you don't really know a priori what's... Should you now put in a small seed black hole mass and let the galaxy adjust to it and see, does the black hole now grow to a certain size, and is then this the right size or not? You know, if you haven't formed this galaxy in a cosmological simulation, you're not absolutely sure whether these properties really are realistic or not.